chair and a subcommittee on community response. Let the record reflect that Senator Verger is on her way in, and Representative McPherson is away on business, I believe.
That's right.
And we hope that the other distinguished senators will be joining us before too long. The intent of today's meeting is an informational meeting. We did ask that several individuals representing the State Troopers Association and the Oregon Council of Police Associations provide us some information, and then after which we're going to start down legislative concepts and have a fairly fluid discussion on those legislative concepts with members of the audience as we get input and try and wean the list of some 50-some, 60-some concepts down in a priority order. With that, what I'd like to do is ask Andy Moy to come up to the podium and identify yourself and please give us the background.
Okay, my name's Andy Moyer, M-O-Y-E-R. I am a trooper out of the state St. Helens office, the State Police Patrol Division, also do training functions. I'm also the vice president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, which represents mainly our troopers as well as our dispatchers. And I understand I was kind of asked to explain our role as troopers or the state police's role for a natural disaster. And mainly our role is one of the reasons actually why the state police was formed back in 1931, because we're a statewide agency. We can respond statewide. We have a statewide communication system. So if I have a trooper from Pendleton that needs to respond to Seaside for a tsunami or an earthquake and respond to Portland, they can respond with their equipment in Pendleton, their car in Pendleton, drive to Portland, and they can immediately talk to a dispatcher in Portland. They flip channels, and they can anywhere in the state they can speak with and communicate with other troopers from the area they're responding to, which is something that we did. I guess the experience that we have was the flood of 96, which affected several different regions and counties in Oregon. That's what we did back then. We had a cadet program. We had an active reserve program. Both those programs don't exist on our department anymore, but we still sent troopers to different areas. They're already equipped. They can already communicate with the other troopers already there to assist. One key thing to remember in a disaster, especially if it would happen in Portland, if a major earthquake would hit Portland, a lot of times what we learned from Katrina and 9/11 is the first responders, whether it be law enforcement officers or paramedics or firefighters, that live and work in that area often become victims themselves. So they're unable to respond from home if they're not already working, or perhaps maybe even be unable to get a hold of them, which is would be a correct role for the state police. We can immediately send people to assist since they can't get their first responders working. We can send people from outside the affected area who are not victims into the affected area from all around. With the state police, we have the Fish and Wildlife Division, so we can send a fleet of four-wheel drive trucks to any area if we need four-wheel drive vehicles, boats if we need to connect, transport first responders from one side of the Willamette River to the other side of the Willamette River. Yes.
Representative Prep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Repeat what you just said about the four-wheel drive trucks.
Well, our Fish and Wildlife Division troopers who normally would check hunting license, fishing license, work up in the logging roads, the Forest Service roads, so they're all assigned four-wheel drive pickups, which a lot of county agencies would have one or two woods deputies or that sort, but with state police, every Fish and Wildlife trooper, and I believe we have about 112 at this point statewide, is assigned a four-wheel drive pickup, and in that four-wheel drive pickup is the same statewide communication system that our patrol vehicles would have. So I would be able to send a Fish and Wildlife Division trooper who's the same authority as a patrol division trooper from Pendleton to Portland or to the coast, and they would be able to have four-wheel drive capability. And the same division, they're in charge of patrolling the rivers and streams, lakes, with by boat. Behind those pickups, they can pull the boats into the affected areas, which could be an important tool to use in Portland if bridges go down, not necessarily to transport people, but to transport first responders from one side of the river to the other side of the river. So although the local agencies there have boats, they would need probably a lot extra boats to perform that function. And again, you can't always rely on the local first responders, because a lot of times they're going to become victims themselves if the tragedy is that large.
Would you hold one minute? Mm-hmm. Is the, since you're on Ways and Means or eBoard or whatever they call it these days, is the 112 Fish and Wildlife, are they part of the trooper structure we're always talking about? Are they part of that headcount?
They're part of the overall headcount. They're not considered part of patrol division.
No, and 112 is a kind of a guesstimate. It's somewhere close to that. We have about the same amount of detectives, and then we have about 319 patrol division troopers. And it just like in the flood of 96, we also put those detectives back in uniforms, back in a car, and sent them out. So we'd have extra bodies, so to speak, from the detective division to be able to perform that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many boats does OSP have?
I don't know the exact number on that. I could get back to you on that. We have several along the coast and several along all the offices along the Columbia River. The smaller offices inland would have maybe some drift boats or some small boats to patrol larger lakes.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, thank you, Andy.
The other problem that the state police would see since the flood of 96, of course, our staffing level has gone downhill since 1980, but even since 1996, it's gone down quite a bit. So our staffing level to send people immediately, it would be a lot harder to do that now than it was in 1996. For example, we would be having a hard time sending someone from an area such as Pendleton or St. Helens to somewhere else, because we would only have one person on patrol in that area at the time. So we would have to, you know, make those phone calls to get off-duty troopers, and so it would take a little bit more time to get that, and we wouldn't have as many to send. But we do have a mobile response team, which used to have anywhere between 65 and 70 members. I believe we're down to about 40 members on the mobile response team, and they're on call on a pager basis, and we utilize them, for example, during the spring break at Seaside. Seaside Police Department calls in for extra help, so we deploy a couple, about 10, 15 troopers during the week of spring break to Seaside to assist with their law enforcement efforts.
Yeah, thank you. Representative.
Thank you. When you've got to take, say, the mobile response team or any other group, take your detectives off, like in the flood of 96, they work overtime. Do you have to come back to eBoard for extra money to do that kind of thing, or are most of these troopers on salary? How do you work that out?
Well, all the troopers, the sergeants and above, which there are some sergeants on those teams, are on salary. Troopers, we do get paid overtime. If I recall, on the flood of 96, we'd keep track of the flood hours, and most of that was reimbursed by the federal government during the flood of 96. However, not all of it was, and that would come out of our direct budget, and if it went over, then our department would have to go to the e-board. And that's how that's also worked for after 9/11, when we went into the Portland airport. We sent we staffed the Portland airport with at the onset right after 9/11 with four troopers at the security checkpoints 24 hours a day at the Portland airport, and that was all on an overtime basis until we would had enough troops to send in on a straight time basis, and that was reimbursed by the federal government as well.
And again, for the record, Representative Krupp, Andy represents the Troopers Association.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, Andy.
And then the other problem besides staffing that we have right now, of course, if we our staffing levels go up, our response would be a lot faster, quicker, and larger to an affected area. The other problem we have is our communication system. Although we do have one of the only statewide communication systems, and it is very old, outdated, and I didn't see that the governor's interoperability task force and the communications network is supposed to be taking effect. I think this session is when they're supposed to set aside the money to do that, which is going to be an enormous budget to redo an entire statewide communication system. So we have some repeaters that are up right now that if they break, you can't even buy the parts now to fix them. So we're hoping they don't break right now. But in the local areas, we the troopers not only can communicate with our dispatchers at the state level. We have two dispatch centers, one in Central Point and one in Salem. And everywhere in the state, the trooper on the road talks to either one of those two dispatch centers. We also have other communications in our vehicles where we talk to the local dispatch center and the local police agencies and sheriff's departments as well. So that's basically our role, the state police's role. Again, the important part to stress is the first responders are going to be victims themselves in the affected area, so it's going to be important to send people from the outside area into those areas. And I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
Or is there probably any questions?
Measure 48 is on the ballot. Okay, it's constitutional spending limit. All right. What are the implications, as you understand it, in terms of the interoperability issue, in terms of us being able to either issue bonds, general obligation bonds, to pay for that upgrade of that network? And it's a question that I think we ought to ask, by the way, LFO. Here's the question I'm posing, Mr. Chair, is that if Measure 48 passes and it restricts our limits spending to a particular level, how would that impact our ability to move forward with an interoperability program? Does it include bonds? Is there a mechanism by which we can issue bonds prior to Measure 48 taking effect, if that were the case, through e-board actions? I don't think so, but I it would be interesting to get that answer from either legal counsel or LFO, to be quite honest with you. Because this is a pretty serious issue in terms of we're still not sure what potential issues are covered under Measure 48. There's a lot of speculation out there, and until it either happens and we're faced with the realities of it, it would be nice to have some contingency direction in ready to go. Mm-hmm. And it may, that's an issue for more than this subcommittee or even our committee, but I think it's something that we ought to explore and talk about so that we can at least alert leadership to what the realities might be, both parties, both houses, and potentially formulate some plan to try and deal with it.
Do you want to respond to it?
Yes, Representative Boquist, Representative Krepp. From what I understand of Measure 48, and I haven't read the entire measure, but the cost for the statewide network, redoing statewide, I've seen numbers as high as $500 million, and my last talk on this was a few weeks ago, and I understand the Fed was going to provide lots of matching money, and they've backed away from that, not providing the matching money, but as much as they were going to provide. So it is going to require probably more of a state budget, and I don't know if Measure 48 would affect that or not. I'm concerned for Measure 48 for the trooper standpoint as far as the staffing levels to extend that, because, of course, our department, to get up to the staffing levels where it needs to increase up a greater percentage than the spending limit allows. So that would come out of some other state budget.
It's a great opportunity to privatize some things, Representative.
That's right. See dollar signs going downhill quickly.
Yeah.
Judith, also on the list for Measure 48, you probably should have legislative counsel determine if there's an emergency clause in there. What happens if there's a catastrophic event?
Right.
And what is the budgetary authority or the ability to exceed the budgetary authority? And I don't know. Do you know, Representative Pepper, is there a clause in there for overriding the emergency?
There, Not for, there's a general clause for overriding that is pretty stringent. It takes 3/5 of the House and Senate, and it's a vote that goes before the people. Both of those things have to occur to bust the spending limit.
So we have to hold an election.
Correct.
We have an election in order to spend that money.
Right.
Well, that could be difficult if Portland is in ruins. Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy.
And is Robert King?
I didn't see him coming along quite yet.
Okay. And I know that Brent wants to address the reverse 911 issue. Would you like to take a few minutes of our time?
Sure.
And
thank you.
And for Representative Krupp, you recall, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe we talked about reverse 911 in Umatilla.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Thank you, sir. Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The OTA, our membership is statewide, and we represent small local incumbent telephone companies as well as larger companies like Verizon Local. I didn't really have any comments to make. I came over here to get some information on reverse 911. That's an issue, obviously, that would impact our membership, and I got some information, and I was just here to avail myself for the community. If there's any questions, I don't know if I could answer them or not, but I could certainly find answers to them. And this is an issue that we'd like to be involved in if it moves forward.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to testify today whether or not we want it to move forward, but we certainly want to be interested in it.
Do you have any, you looked at some of the material that was provided to us in Umatilla. Do you have any comments on that or any additions to that material that was provided over there?
Well, Mr. Chair, I briefly glanced through it. It looks to me like it's something that will be purchased by somebody. I'm not sure who would do the purchasing of that, or is it?
No one after Measure 4.
I'm just, the questions I have, does each PSAP have to purchase this software, or each county? I mean, those are the kinds of questions I have. This, and then also, the list of potential legislative concepts indicated it will be a voluntary county-by-county kind of plan. So I would like to know what that means exactly.
But I can assure you, probably in speaking out of tune for Representative Krupp, that there will be no mandate unfunded going downhill, at least the two of us vote on.
Likely so.
but unfortunately, you know, who knows exactly. And I think in response to the legislative concept, one of the intents we're trying to do is, again, to pare down and determine, you know, what would be the priorities.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as I'm learning from Representative Butler, the chairman of Revenue Committee, that legislative process is a very long, ongoing, multi-session type process. So once an idea is hatched here, it might take 2 or 3 sessions to bear fruit or not get water and die on the vine.
Sure.
Sure. Interesting thought. Instead of a mandate for local PSAPs to provide 911, reverse 911 capability, why not tax credits of some type, either foundationally? I mean, these are government agencies, obviously, local PSAPs are, so they don't pay taxes. What about the ability to encourage some method through a tax credit incentive for them to be able to, as an incentive for them to take part in the program and purchase it. Because it sort of goes back to the discussion about Measure 48. If you limit the amount of money that can be spent and there's still lots of money coming in, the question would be, what if you put some type of a tax incentive out there which has no relation to how much money is spent, but would create an incentive outside of the, because they're local government PSAPs, they don't have general fund issues having to do, so there would be some incentive then through a tax incentive of some type, somewhere, to allow local governments, because keep in mind, Measure 48 doesn't apply to local governments at all, only applies to state general fund. Okay, so if it doesn't apply to local governments, then there's no restriction. So what kind, if if we have a problem in providing funding for that, then what policy could we put in place to encourage the flow of funds to the local level to create that as an incentive for them to do to engage in purchasing that type of reverse 911? That's my point to you. Is there another direction we can approach this that's out of the box?
Instead of amending. So what you're suggesting, and we'll ask Brent to comment, what you're suggesting is, what if the state created the authority for a local entity to provide a tax credit to a provider that would help offset the costs of a operation?
Exactly. That's the idea. That's definitely
outside of the box.
It is outside the box.
Any thoughts on that? Have you ever heard of that working elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no, I haven't heard of that before, but I'm not the most, broadly informed individual in the world, for the record.
Well, neither is the chair, I can tell you that.
Or this member.
But we're happy to explore all these options. We wouldn't necessarily be opposed to a reverse 911 system. We would just need to know exactly what that means technically to the local exchange companies, small phone companies, and large phone companies, and how we would, interact with this system. And the funding, obviously, is another issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I will make sure I have left my information with the committee administrator, Ms. Collins, and as this moves forward, if it does, then we'll just be a part of the conversation.
Mr. Chair, do we have any sense of what it costs to upgrade to reverse 911 capability for a local PSAP? Do we have any hard dollar costs?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, according to this information I received, there's a $78,000 looks like a hard cost, and then an annual fee of about $12,000 per system, I guess. That's the question I don't have, I don't have the answer to. So there are some costs associated with it, and that's why I don't recall exactly how many PSAPs there are in the state, but there are 36 counties times whatever this is, and it adds up quick. So
it adds
something
up large
to consider.
Too.
Yeah.
But thank God we have local PSAPs.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true.
We support them.
Thank you very much, Brent.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence.
Joan, would you join us at the podium? Joan, our question was, based on Measure 48, is there some sort of, and our committee deals with catastrophic emergencies. If there were a catastrophic event, catastrophic emergency, to your knowledge, under the proposed Measure 48, is there an emergency clause in the event there was a tsunami or something and the state had to expend funds that it normally wouldn't expend?
John Robinson, Legislative Council. Mr. Chair, I don't have a copy of Measure 48 with me, and I think someone's going to bring one, but I don't remember that there's a out for emergency situations other than just the normal ways that the measure allows exceeding the spending cap, which are a supermajority of the legislature and a vote by the people in a general election. So if it happens when it's too late for something to go to the general election, then I don't know what happens.
Questions? So then it wouldn't allow a special election?
No. It does not allow a special election.
Okay.
So then, to the best of your recollection, if we had a catastrophic event and we went into special session, the only recourse, it sounds that we would have immediate recourse, is to catastrophically cut other agencies to create funds to deal with the emergency.
If it's too late to refer something to the general election, and the general election is established by the Constitution as the
right
first Tuesday after the second Monday in November, whatever it is, so that can't be changed. And there are federal and state laws that affect the last possible date for sending a measure to the general election, and I believe it would be sometime in August or possibly September. Federal law requires that absentee ballots be overseas absentee ballots be mailed or in the hands of the voters 45 days before the election. So that's a limit on when the legislature could refer something. So pretty much after August or September of an even-numbered year, there's no way to deal with it.
Then in, I guess, how do I pose this? The, does it require a 50% turnout?
No, it does not.
So then, hypothetically, if you did get it there and portions of the coast and portions of Portland weren't available to vote, where they were refugees, and that's what this committee deals with, then there isn't a 50% limitation.
No. Just
it's a warm
a majority of people who come and vote or who are able to vote, who do vote.
Mr. Chair, in you're thinking about how we do things in ways and means, Joan, under this particular, the provisions of Measure 48, and given that we have biannual budgets, if we had a catastrophic event where we needed to expend additional money, is there, you could hold a special session to temporarily reduce other budgets and free up money to put into the catastrophic response.
Okay. Yes. The overall spend, it's an overall spending limit,
right,
but it's not a spending limit for any particular agency or expenditure or anything like that. So as long as the overall spending limit is adhered to, you can have a special session to move money around as much as you'd like to.
So what I'm driving at, Mr. Chair, is the process of where we could comply with the provisions of Measure 48 and how it would change the Constitution and still be able to manage this situation. It's my belief that if we had an extreme situation where you had a catastrophic event in Portland or, frankly, anywhere else in the state, that we could override Measure 48, but it would take time to do that. I think there would be a lot of public... I'm talking about the provisions that Measure 48 allows for you to bust the constitutional spending limit. In other words, to hold a special session, get three-fifths, but then you have to wait until the next general election, whenever that is, timing-wise. I'm just trying to think through how we could manage that and stay within the boundaries of Measure 48's provisions, should it become a constitution. So that's why I'm thinking, I would think there would be a tremendous sympathy amongst the people of Oregon as there was after 9/11, and frankly after the flood of 96, a lot of statewide sympathy for these kinds of things. They would think that we would be able to bust the spending limit, certainly in the legislative level, and then I think clearly the people would be sympathetic that, well, you would have to have a general election, you would have to wait. So in the meantime, how do you manage all of this? Well, there are ways that we borrow money temporarily from certain treasury funds. There's tax anticipation notes. I'm a local fire board member waiting for our property taxes to come in. We can borrow money. There's a number of management tools, and frankly, I think we ought to have that discussion as to how we would potentially manage. How could we hold a special session, temporarily reduce other state budgets, look at borrowing mechanisms? All of that is a roll of the dice because you would have to place that all. Ultimately, you've got to replace those funds somewhere. And that means going to the people and asking them to bust the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so how would we manage that until we could get to a general election? That's the question I'm asking here. What mechanisms exist currently where we could make those decisions and manage a crisis until we got to a general election to ask people for help?
Could you ask someone, see if we can get someone from LFO? come up. Do you have any, Joan, any comments on that?
Well, one of the, I think, if I understood you correctly, Representative Krupp, you're thinking perhaps of having a scenario that has a special session of the legislature after it's too late to send something to the general election and then waiting for the following general election. I believe that one of the ambiguities of Measure 48 is it may not allow that, because it says the limit on total spending established by this section for each biennium may be exceeded for that biennium by an amount approved by two-thirds of each House and referred to and approved by a majority of electors voting on the issue in a general election. You have to wind up the budget at the end of a biennium in practical terms as close as possible after the end of a biennium. So you're talking about waiting. So the next biennium will end June 30th of 2007. If that were the biennium in which you wanted to exceed a spending limit right now, for example, you'd have to wait until November of 2008 for a general election. It would be for a prior biennium. I have no idea what would happen if the people voted no. Your budget would be out of balance at the end of the biennium and for quite a while after that. Also, the spending limitation, well, it exempts proceeds from the sale of bonds specifically approved by the voters. It does not appear to exempt other kinds of borrowed monies.
So, Mr. Chair, it exempts the sale of bonds specifically approved by the voters. Those words say it exempts the sale of the bonds.
Proceeds from the sale of
the
bonds.
The proceeds. It doesn't say that spending, appropriating, and expending those proceeds is outside of this measure, correct?
I guess I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm sorry.
If these are exemptions, item number 6 is an exemption that's not covered under Measure 48,
mm-hmm.
It says, no, I'm wrong, because it's saying in under paragraph sub A, it says authorizing the expenditure of public funds except disbursements, and a disbursement would be an expenditure. And so if we sell bonds approved by the voters, and I'm assuming those bonds would be general obligation bonds?
The measure itself does not make a distinction between general obligation bonds and revenue bonds. So that's another ambiguity. I certainly, from the language, you can't tell that it's just general obligation bonds.
So, Mr. Chair, let me ask this question. Could you sell bonds to cover an emergency and have that outside of Measure 48?
Again, it would have to be bonds specifically approved by the voters, and I believe that one of the questions that's still up in the air is, what does that mean? When do the bonds have to be specifically approved by the voters? And does each issuance of bonds have to be specifically approved by the voters? As you know, there's a general bond limit in the Constitution of $50,000. So general obligation bonds, most general obligation bonds are in fact approved by the voters. But highway bonds or the revenue type bonds are not. So I don't know. I believe people at Department of Justice are working on that kind of question to try to figure out what it actually means.
So Mr. Chair, here's what I'm thinking. Again, if we're talking about managing a crisis, if Measure 48 passes, is it possible that we could sell bonds to pay for the emergency, to pay for the rebuilding, to pay for hiring helicopters and truck drivers and rebuilding bridges and all of that kind of thing? If we sold bonds for that, would that be outside of Measure 48? Could we do that in a special session? Could we put a special issue in front of the voters out of a special session with a special election to sell those bonds?
And to follow up, the reason we're asking this, I mean, the exact truth of the matter is the state of Louisiana in the first 30 days spent $3.1 billion outside of their budget in the first 30 days. So the question is, if you had such an event like a tsunami on the Oregon coast and you spent $3 billion, that's 25% of the general fund, we got a serious budget problem on our hands. And, of course, they were just expending with no recourse. Now, I don't believe the state of Louisiana had or has a constitutional balanced budget like we do. So in our case, yeah, it makes a difference, right? Now, of course, the matching fund was like $3.6 billion for the first month from the feds, which they're still arguing with the federal government. So I think the total bill is like $6.6 billion to Louisiana in the first month, which would now be 50% of our general fund. The question is how do you turn to emergency services and the military department and everybody else and say, you know, you need to fix this and get moving when there's no budgetary authority to do it? I think that's one legal question. And then I think Ken Rocco was on this upstairs to tell us a practical application of how you might respond to this.
I think it's also, as part of the legal question, which also slops over into practical question that the treasurer or somebody from the treasurer's office or maybe Rocco could answer, but I believe that although proceeds from the sale of bonds specifically approved by the voters are exempted from the definition of total spending, monies used to repay the bonds are not. So you build that into your budget, and that has to be within the spending limit too. So at some point, I mean, yes, legally it would be possible to have a special session to send a bond measure to the voters. And I believe the proceeds from the sales of bonds approved by the voters in that scenario could be used without violating the spending cap. I have no idea how the bond market would feel about that kind of bond, what the state would have to pay for it. I mean, that's the kind of thing the treasurer knows, and I don't. That's why he's the treasurer and I'm not. one of several reasons. But again, I think I don't know about bond repayment costs, and I don't know how fast bond repayment costs mount up. I just don't know.
Mr. Chair, as part of the history of this place, you remember in 2002 when we had five special sessions, we actually
I'll never forget.
How could we forget? We did actually finance some of our shortfall by issuing bonds. Not tremendous amounts. We still cut a couple of billion dollars out of our budget, but we did finance some of this. So it is not precedent-setting what we're talking about doing here, I don't believe. It's most unusual, but this would be a most unusual situation. This would be a catastrophic situation. And what I would envision, Mr. Chair, is that if we did sell bonds in this manner, yes, you have to repay those bonds. You would have to build that into your next budget. But that would give you time to hold a general election to ask the people if they would take any surplus funds and bust the budget. Let the people make that decision. In other words, it buys you time. And if the people said no, we're not going to do that, then you are faced with you're actually faced with having to build those long-term repayment costs, and typically you're looking at 20-year repayment costs on bond issues. Mm-hmm. And so then you get to how does that impact your budgets for the next 20 years? And usually you're paying over double. Mm-hmm. So if you borrow $1 billion in bonds, you're going to pay well over $2 billion. And again, Joan's right, it would depend on interest rates, mm-hmm. how the bond market would view such a thing. If it's backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon and our bond rating is still in good shape, it's doable. Again, I'm just trying to explore ways in which we can manage an issue of this nature.
So let me understand, well, Joan's still here, so that I have clarity on it. What we're saying is that if Measure 48 passed and there was a catastrophic disaster, that through a special session, we could authorize, without a vote of the people, a bond?
No. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The proceeds from the sale of bonds that are exempted from the definition of total spending are bonds specifically approved by the voters. So the legislature would have to approve issuance of bonds for specific, I guess for specific purposes, approve the sale, and then send that, refer that to the people for a vote. But it could, that vote could happen at a special election.
Right.
And then if the people approved the sale of bonds, then the proceeds from that sale would be exempt from the spending limitation for that biennium.
And in your knowledge or your recollection, that it would still require 45 days notice to do a special election. Correct?
I'm sorry, my colleague Ted Reitlinger is not here because he's the one who understands the election law. I believe so, although, I mean, I know there's a point after which it's too late. It's too late for ballots to be sent overseas. It's too late for ballots to be printed. It's too late. I mean, the legislature can do some of the time-consuming stuff, like write the ballot title and all that, and, you know, bypass all of that process legislatively. But at some point, it's the time where the Secretary of State has to say, that's it, we can't, or the county clerks, we can't have an election that soon. But I'm not sure. I don't know whether you would be under federal, if you had a special election solely for the purpose of voting on Oregon bonds, I don't know whether the federal law on overseas absentee ballots would apply. I just don't know. I can find out. I mean, Ted's on vacation for 2 weeks, but I can find out before you're going to send any bond measures to the voters.
we're hoping never to do that. We're having this discussion.
Amen to that.
As a follow-up question to that, because is there, under this, and you might not know the answer to this question, you might come back to this, you know, and I use the $3 billion mark that was just, I mean, the line in the sand from Louisiana. Having said that, given the parameters and the foresight of the legislature, I would hope, in such an event, is there a distribution restriction? And what I'm thinking about here is, you know, we have counties and we have cities who are now spending money vastly outside of their budgeting authority and vastly outside of their capability. Would there be a restriction on the state, you know, I guess block granting or transferring funds to the cities and counties to pay for disaster response?
That's a good point. So Mr. Chair, if Measure 48 is passed and we have $1 billion sitting in our ending balance, because under provisions of Measure 48, it doesn't say it has to be returned to the voters. Mm-hmm. It just sits there. So if we got $1 billion sitting there, could we appropriate that money to cities and counties in a special session to pay for their portion of emergency response costs?
Exactly. Because the cities and counties, Coos Bay won't exist. We've said that in these hearings so many times. Seaside won't exist for all practical purposes. And so the tax base isn't going to exist, but the public need for public services will exist. So,
well, Measure 48 says total spending means all disbursements pursuant to all acts by the Legislative Assembly authorizing the expenditure of public funds, except... I don't know. The first exception is money to fund emergency or rainy day funds. I don't know whether that exception is intended to be broad enough to cover the scenario that you are talking about, but I doubt it. Federal funds, kicker monies, tax refunds, bonds, proceeds from sale of real property, and any monies voluntarily donated to a state agency. I mean, there's nothing on the face of Measure 48 that authorizes sending monies to local governments as being outside of the spending limit.
Okay, Joan, in subparagraph 2A1, money to fund emergency or rainy day funds, emergency funds. How would you define money to fund emergency? Money to fund emergency funds. How would you define that? Or how do you think they might define it if they're sponsoring this thing?
Well, I'm not sure, because a lot of the language in Measure 48 doesn't track very well with the current language of the budgeting process around here. So the emergency, what budgeting people in the Capitol think of as the emergency fund is a fund that's appropriated usually in one of the last bills of the session, monies that are appropriated to the emergency board either for specific purpose for special appropriations, specific purpose appropriations, or for the general emergency fund to be allocated by the emergency board during the interim. However, if one actually exempts all the money that's appropriated to the to what we think of as the emergency fund, then it seems to me that's a fairly big hole in this, because the legislature will just have to appropriate, you know, $3 billion to the emergency fund, and then the emergency board could allocate it in the ways they're allowed to allocate money without coming under the spending limit. So my guess is that's not what it means.
Mr. Chair, I think the operative term there, I frankly agree with Joan. I think the operative term is money to fund emergency funds. Funding it is different than expending it.
Well, but the emergency... yes, I'm sorry, Representative Krupp, yes, it is. Normally, spending of money requires an appropriation by the Legislative Assembly. The Constitution says that. There has to be an appropriation. The monies that are spent by the emergency board are not appropriated by the emergency board. They're appropriated by the Legislative Assembly to the emergency board.
Right.
And then my friend Mr. Rocco spends them. Oh, no. Sorry.
Only when we vote to allow him.
Yes, only when you vote to allow him to. So in that case, if we were to interpret this to mean that monies to fund the emergency fund, in other words, monies appropriated to what we now think of as the emergency fund, are outside the spending limit, then the expenditure of those monies by the emergency board would not be an expenditure in the terms of Measure 48 as we are trying to fit it into our current budgeting language. But as I said, it doesn't fit into the current budgeting language, and I find it difficult to believe that the drafters intend that the Legislative Assembly can appropriate $3 billion to the emergency fund outside of the spending limit, for the emergency board to spend outside of the spending limit.
Okay. Kim, what we're talking about is catastrophic emergencies. And if you're familiar with the Louisiana case where, I mean, the first month they spent $3 billion, that would be 25% of our budget. I mean, what we're trying to do is figure out, in a what-if situation, how would we deal with a $3 billion shortfall? What are the options, and then Measure 48 thrown into it. With Measure 48, one of the options, I guess the bottom line is if we needed $3 billion to replace the Oregon coast because it was gone, how would we do it quickly?
Under Measure 48, how would we manage it?
Mr. Chair, Ken Rockefeller, Fiscal Office. I think the best way of doing that would be to go to the federal government and get $3 billion from them. Because it's excluded from federal funds are excluded from the spending limit. I don't know how willing they would be to do that, but that would be the best way.
A lot of heads are shaking no behind you.
The challenge game we face is that I believe Louisiana is in court right now with the federal government, because not only did Louisiana spend their money, but then the federal government billed them $3.6 billion for their portion of what the federal government spent. And so I think they're now at $6.7 billion in the hole and have no solution, which that's now, I guess, what, 50% of our general fund. I mean, to have cash flow, what do we legally have to do to have cash flow to conduct, you know, sustained emergency operations over a 30-day period, which could amount to $3 billion?
Well, the... this caused some difficulties for the state, the measure, in the scenario you're painting. Bonds, you could sell bonds, but usually for bonds you have to have some type of method of repayment. So, for example, in 02, we referred a measure to the people that was approved for appropriation bonds. Now, the debt service stream identified for that was the tobacco master settlement monies. Not specifically, but that was what the plan was. And because of that, the bonds were able to be sold with a relatively decent interest rate.
If you have no way of paying back except some proposed tax increase in the future, I don't know if you'd be able to market a bond very well to take care of an issue like this.
Representative Krupp.
Regarding, thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding Fed funds, do we currently, on a short-term basis, borrow money from the federal government and then turn around and repay it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no, I don't believe we borrow money. Sometimes we spend money in anticipation of getting federal funds later. So we're actually, for an example, in the Medicaid program, you spend your money, then the feds give you their portion after you've sent their bills.
I see the director's office back there in the back hiding, I think.
not for long.
So then, Ken, in an event like this, let me make it easier so that I can just... Because if we're at the beginning of a biennium, and, you know, we had a 12... General fund is $12 billion. How do we... What mechanisms happen to happen if by luck has it, the tsunami happens in the first quarter or the first 4 or 5 months of a biennium, and so therefore we have this budget that's $12 billion in front that we have to balance 2 years out in front of us. What mechanisms have to be put in place for the state to, you know, quadruple or, I mean, 100 times more money goes into emergency services than is ever budgeted? I mean, what is the process? Would we have to go into special session? How do we get, or can the governor declare an emergency and say, all right, you know, we're going to spend whatever it takes and we're going to take it from this pie and put it in that pie, or what's the scenario?
Mr. Chair, the budget is just a plan for how you're going to spend your money, your anticipated money for the next 2 years. So as soon as the budget's passed, the first day of the biennium, you don't have the $12 billion in hand. You have a plan for how you're going to spend it, and you've given it to agencies, or you've given them the authority to get it at some point. So you would have to come back in the special session and reallocate how you were planning on spending the money. So, like, take money away from K-12, for example. You said you were going to give them $6 billion. Well, now you're only going to give them $5.5 billion and use a $500 million for this immediate need. Plan for that. Now, at the end of the biennium, when you don't, the issue comes in when you're trying to maintain all these other programs at their previous level, and under the spending limit scenario, then you have other hurdles to jump over, which include the vote of the people, two-thirds of each house, and a vote of the people in a general election to break the spending limit. So even if you have the money available to you.
Right, and so what we have abilities to borrow money from funds. We do that all the time between agencies who have short-term cash flow issues. We do it at the local level with tax anticipation notes regarding property taxes in my fire district, those types of things. We're trying to talk about how you could physically manage something until you could get to a general election to ask the voters to bust the budget. Are there ways to do that? Yes, you'd have to go in special session, reallocate, but you got to replace that money because you'll never get the votes. If you're going to take $500 million from K-12, that's going to be politically pretty hard to do inside this building. So how could you do it if you were saying the deal is amongst ourselves as legislators? Yeah, well, there's a way we can pay it back if the voters will say, yeah, we can bust the budget in a crisis.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, this seems to be somewhat of a legal question about whether you...
whether that's what she said about you, and this was a financial issue.
So she passed you and you're lateraling back to her. So,
because of the way... I don't know if the measure would put any kind of legal problem on the legislature if you voted to break the spending limit without having, let's say, 18 months in advance of getting a voter approval, or 12 months in advance. I don't know if that's an issue or not.
So Ken, regardless if Measure 48 wasn't there, it sounds to me like, you know, if we had a catastrophic event on the Oregon coast, one of these Cascadia things, and basically most of the coast is gone and a good portion of the bridges in the Willamette Valley are gone, I mean, almost one of the very first things you're going to have to do would be called a special session, to because you're going to be reallocating budget no matter what.
Yeah.
Is that under the present structure, is that a correct assumption?
Mr. Chair, yes. Yeah, I don't see how you would deal with it otherwise, because you wouldn't have any you might have typically $30 to $40 million in the emergency fund, which could be used for that. But if you're talking about something of that magnitude, there would be no way that under the existing budget structure that you could deal with it. You'd have to have some kind of a special session action.
You can also, Mr. Chair, and I don't know anything about how this would fly politically, but you can refer a proposed amendment to the Constitution to a special election. So the legislature could come into special session and propose suspending Measure 48 or repealing Measure 48 or something like that, and send that to a special election. And then it could do for that biennium, at least, whatever you needed to do. I don't know whether that's politically easier. I don't know, as I said before, I don't know, and I don't think anybody will know until you try it, what happens if you break the spending limit in one biennium and get approval, you know, a year later from the people. I think that's one of those questions that's not answered. Well, for that matter, if you break the spending limit and never get approval from the people, I don't know what will happen.
Well, Mr. Chair, we can refresh my memory, but when we have DHS rebalance issues, they do sometimes go from one biennium to the other, don't they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there are issues that are dealt with across biennia, but the budget situation is defined at the end of, I mean, we calculate how much they need through the end of the biennium, and then we figure how much they need for the next one. So they have some cash flow issues, and we try to deal with that by giving them some money that they, and again, this is related to the federal government's payment schedule, partly related to that. So we give them general fund up front and then expect them, when they receive the other fund's revenue, to pay those bills off and then free up the general fund again, and then we get it back at the end of the biennium. It reverts back to the general fund. And then that money is available for the next budget cycle. But although issues may carry across biennium of the budget, we cut off the budget as of June 30th of the odd number year.
Okay. Thank you, Jim and Ken. Appreciate it. Let's hope it never happens. Let's pray it never happens. And we'll ask the Treasurer's Office to come up.
What, Measure 48 or the crisis?
The crisis.
Are there anything different?
Oh, careful now. What was that editorial comment?
What we're talking about is a what if. And if you're familiar with the situation in Louisiana, I mean, we deal with catastrophic emergencies. We're talking about a tsunami. I know the Treasurer's Office hasn't been involved in it, but I mean, I won't paint you the scenario. I'll just tell you there won't be an Oregon coast. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, this good portion of the Willamette Valley is.
Or a terrorist, a Hezbollah dirty bomb in Portland.
Yeah. Or something.
Which is a viable scenario, by the way.
Something along that line. What Louisiana did in the first month is they spent about $3.1 billion. The federal government billed them $3.6 billion, so that's $6 billion in the first month. That's half. That'd be half our general fund. The question that we're kind of just exploring the what if on is Measure 48 talks about bonding is outside of the budget, and kind of what we're looking at is, you know, how would we finance something? What legal parameters are there, or how would we possibly finance you know, a response to a catastrophic disaster like this.
How would we manage the cash flow, Mr. Chair, if I may, until we could either get to a general election and ask the people to bust the budget, the constitutional spending cap, or our bonds, as listed here in the text of the measure, are the sale and the expenditure of those bonds approved by the people in a special election? Are those outside of measure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, Kate Richardson, Office of the State Treasurer, those are a lot of questions, and they're all different ones. So we will try to pick through them one at a time. To the just general, because cash flow is one question, and budget expenditures is another question, Measure 48 overlay, and then the issuance of bonds in an emergency, which I think is one you were referring to, Louisiana. So I will have Laura Lockwood McCall, our debt management director, speak to first and what Louisiana did and what options may be available for us under that scenario outside of Measure 48 for the time being, just so you can get that.
And we understand for the record this is pretty much off the cuff without research. We're just kind of trying to explore this so we have some parameters going forward in the future.
And
so we'll not hold you to this.
Oh, thank you, because I'm pretty much off the cuff.
But we may want to ask her to clarify later on in another meeting.
Then my remarks will be short. Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of Debt Management in the State Treasurer's Office. Ironically, about 15 minutes ago, before I knew I was coming over here, I was reading the most recent issue of the National Association of State Treasurers newsletter, and it had a nice little two pages about what Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama have been doing. Now, granted, I skim-read it because I didn't know I was going to be quizzed today, but among the things that I noted that they had done, I didn't know about the cash flow, but I assumed that they had the ability to do inter-fund borrowing and to waiting for the federal government to come in with the cash to reimburse them for expenses. And I'm assuming that we have that same ability from a short-term cash flow. I would assume that we would be able to borrow between funds. We do it periodically now. So that would continue on. Of course, you're going to hope that the people will come and bail you out if you needed the money.
Right.
But we do something similar. We have the ability under state law to do tax anticipation revenue notes, and we have done those periodically. So I'm going to assume off the top of my head that kind of a temporary short-term situation would be doable under our current statutes. When it came to other things that I noted that Louisiana had done reading through this newsletter, I noted that they had created a small business fund because one of the things they needed to do was to get small businesses back up on their feet and re-energized. It appeared to me that they had various waiving of federal tax laws that let them go above and beyond what their normal private activity bond caps would be. So, for example, we have a private activity bond cap in our state of about $300 million, give or take, a year to do bonds for private activities for small businesses, home, and they needed to do far more than that. And federal legislation was passed to allow Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama to basically bust through what would normally be the federal tax limits. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know they had a loan program that was run through their Office of Economic Development that was funded up and had reserves, so basically guarantees they were able to go out in the bond markets and basically offer loans at relatively attractive interest rates. If it came to things here in the state that had to do with infrastructure, if the coasts were damaged, for example, we have the ability under state law to issue bonds through the Oregon Department of Transportation, because I would assume that one of the areas that we would need to work on would be roads. And so we have the ability to bond for that.
Question on that. So because ODOT, let me give you the nutshell scenario around there. We get 10 minutes warning. We have 60 to 90 foot in the first wave. The Oregon coast sinks 6 feet. There is no Highway 101. There are virtually no feeder roads to the coast. We got this spot right here, Ken? Coos Bay is gone. Seaside is gone. Most anything in that area is gone. And ODOT, you know, is one of the principal duties of ODOT, of course, is to reopen those roads as quickly as possible. So what you're saying is ODOT, you know, does the legislature have to kick into gear? Can ODOT go out and issue bonds outside of measure.
Well, we have a bond bill that we do each biennium that authorizes different state agencies to issue up to a certain dollar amount. Mm-hmm. ODOT has the ability to issue highway user tax revenue bonds based on their revenue streams. It's not my understanding the legislature specifies every single project, although I know that you're informed and updated fairly regularly about the OTIA programs.
Thank God. Can you imagine the pork that would be that?
So I'm not afraid. I don't know that. I'm not sure I'm the individual, since I don't work in ODOT, to tell you that level of detail. Mm-hmm. I can just tell you on a high level mm-hmm. that we have the ability to issue highway user tax revenue bonds. And this most recent legislative session, I want to say it was in excess of $900 million. Now, we've issued approximately $350 million this biennium, and we plan to sell another $400 this recently. But that's the kind of scale of authority. Now, whether there's the adequate revenue stream to support the debt service on those bonds would be something somebody would want to spend more time on. But I think the answer is yes. There would be an ability to tap the credit markets if necessary.
But to your question on authority, as Laura mentioned, the ODOT can issue up to the authority they have, but mm-hmm. for any further issuance of any type of bond, it's the legislature holds that authority. And so if you were looking at doing something other than what was already in place, that would require additional legislative authority.
So that, Mr. Chair, then gets to the question about Measure 48, because as I read the text of the measure, those ODOT bonds, those expenditures, are covered under the constitutional spending limit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krepp, we believe so. Right now there is an exemption. I've got it. But in fact, I've got so many copies. I think they're all the same.
Yeah, we hope so.
There are some exceptions, as you know, and you have money to fund emergency funds as one, and we haven't looked at that and haven't really thought in terms of that exception. Of course, we've looked at the one that, or we're starting to look at the one that accepts proceeds from the sale of bonds specifically approved by voters. Some of the terms, we're asking for legal advice on exactly what does that mean. Some of the things we've noted is that bonds specifically approved by voters is not very clear to us, because unlike school districts or other local governments, you guys are the ones that approve the bonds. We don't send out individual sales to the voters. Mm-hmm. There are bond programs that are in the Constitution and have been approved by voters. We don't have any advice yet on whether that meets this language. Also, as you know, it says proceeds from the sale of bonds. It says, okay, those are the proceeds, but then there's the expenditure of those. And does the expenditure, proceeds and expenditure, is that the same thing? It doesn't cover debt service. So in the repayment of debt service, do you count the principal and interest? There are lots of questions that have come out of that little line, and we are just now asking the Attorney General, or we've been asking the Attorney General on this, to see what falls under there and what does not. So it doesn't go to money to fund your emergency funds. That's really your question. Whether you use the exception, or whether proceeds from the sale of bonds specifically by voters captures those, we don't know.
Let me, because we talked about this with Ken and Joan beforehand, and I think I understand what Laura said. Is, I mean, ODOT has bonding authority based on the previously approved budget, which we'll say it's $900 million, and they've spent $300 million. I'm assuming it would take a special session. The special session could direct ODOT to shift that money out of OTIA or whatever it is,
right,
and spend that for this emergency. So you just got $600 million. So now we're one-fifth of the way there. The other question to your, and I'm looking for kind of just a reaction, is if we manage to, and we talked this through with Joan, if we got a special session and we put a $3 billion bond issue to the voters, and remember, part of the voters aren't voting because part of Portland's not there and the coast might not be there in portions mm-hmm. of it. You don't need, there's no 50% turnout. So now you have the authority to go out and borrow $3 billion. What are we talking about here? Are we talking, because Unfortunately, just so you know, Louisiana didn't get the money from the federal government. In fact, the federal government sent them a bill. But Louisiana, I don't believe, has a spending cap authority. And so they just started borrowing money and spending, and now they're trying to figure out how to buy their way out of this.
That was going to be my point, sir. If we can get authorization to borrow anything, and frankly, Wall Street, for a certain given price, will give you money. Question is, how are we going to repay it? And what resources would we be able to apply over time? And that will have a big impact on the interest rates that we'll pay and the story that we'll tell to borrowers.
Mr. Chair, the scenario that I talked about previously is if Measure 48 is in place, especially under the current fiscal analysis that LFO's completed for us, there would be something in excess of $1 billion sitting in an ending fund balance, for lack of a better term. The legislature could create an emergency fund out of that, but it couldn't be spent.
Right.
Unless the provisions of this, there's a two-thirds vote of the legislature and it goes into a general election approved by the voters. So if we were going to, let's assume that item number six, proceeds from the sale of bonds specifically approved by the voters. Mm-hmm. Let's say we go into special session, we got a $3 billion hole to fix. Let's say we sell, all right, we're going to sell we got $1 billion sitting in this ending fund balance. We're going to sell $1 billion worth of bonds, or we're going to sell $3 billion worth of bonds, backed by this $1 billion that's sitting there in cash.
Which you may or may not be able to get.
Which you may or may not be able to get because you've got to wait to a general election to go ask the voters to bust it. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you could sell those bonds. If the market would allow it, if we decide the reasonable interest rate was okay, we got to figure out now the market's going to want to know, obviously, how are you going to repay that?
Yes, and depending on what exactly got damaged and destroyed, that could also have some implications.
Some impact on that.
Because let's just say worst case, it was Portland. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the economic engine of the region. So even if you had that billion, first you have to hope and pray and analyze what you think the likelihood of getting voter approval is. So you'll pay for that uncertainty in the market. But then if the economic engine that's not there for the next 10 or 15 years, because you're not going to try and pay it all back at once, but over time, there'll be a calculation as to how likely can that economic engine repay the debt.
So and that all is built into the interest rate that they're
sure.
charging.
It's everyone else, the investor's analysis of your likelihood as well as your ability to pay. We may have the likelihood to pay because we are a fine upstanding state. It's more about our ability to pay. And, you know, and I think that's true for Louisiana because, you have to take a look at their economy, where their revenues were coming from.
That's why they've opened the casinos immediately.
And oil revenues are good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, let me ask a question. Is it legal in theory, because I know the various entities within your office and related entities, you know, manage various funds. Is there legally an ability, for a better word, to borrow within ourselves, within the same group? Now, I know there's bonding processes. You know, we have all kinds of consultants. So I think you understand what I'm saying because I think Treasurer's Office manages trust funds and pension funds and everything else like that and actually buys bonds and of other places too for good return.
Very good return, thank you. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to give you a legal opinion here, although I'm a lawyer, I'm not practicing, and so I'm going to give myself cover that way. So, if I understand your question, we do for cash flow purposes a certain amount of inter-fund borrowing and also now from the market as well. That's for cash flow, and there are certain restrictions on that. Mm-hmm. The state has always managed itself because, of course, our tax receipts come in not on a steady basis, and they don't necessarily match up with our expenditures. But we have always done that for cash flow, not on a budget.
Right, understand. The issue we're talking about is, in fact, you know, if we're at the beginning of a cash flow issue, I mean, you got to figure out how to open roads, you got to figure out how to provide medical services, you got to figure out how to, you know, get water to the coast and food to the coast and everything else like that in one of these scenarios. So, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talking about restrictions, Kate, are those restrictions constitutional? Are they statutory at the state level?
Are there federal restrictions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there is trust law that governs some of that because of the trust fund nature of many of those funds. There are investment policy requirements. There are and the fact that you know, when you borrow cash from one place, essentially, let's say you're making a loan. It's sort of an investment to whatever fund you're borrowing from, and it has to meet that threshold and also not jeopardize that fund. So there are yes, parameters. I think some are constitutional in the sense that some of those funds are constitutionally created and may, but from a cash flow point of view, I think mostly they're statutory. I don't know about federal.
Okay.
And I'm really not the person to be answering these questions because this is off the cuff.
Right. And we understand that. And we understand that. But I mean, one of the things charges the subcommittee and the main committee is to get everybody thinking that, you know, should this happen, God forbid, and we all hope it doesn't happen, but, you know, now suddenly we have a crisis and, you know, men and women sitting behind you in the room are just so told to do it. Now we've got to figure out how we pay for it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when we turn around and say, okay, you know, we need 500 tents or 300 trucks, we don't have time to argue about, well, where's the money going to come from?
Paul Halliburton.
Yeah. No, don't even start me down to KBR. I was there. So that's kind of the thing, you know, we're doing it. Does the $3 billion or the, does that scare you?
Well, we work with billions all the time, Mr. Chair. So the number $3 billion doesn't scare us, but it should scare you. And you're talking about raising funds,
right.
Raising that amount of cash so that it could be expended. And those are really two separate questions, really, is raising the cash.
Right.
And I think, as Laura described, there are ways we probably can do that. At a price. And then your second question here, your Measure 48 question really is, then can we spend those?
Right. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Representative Krupp, anything else?
Mr. Chair, that gets us a little bit further down the road. And as you, I think our next meeting is in September, correct?
Yeah.
As you get a little further down the road with some of the legal interpretations regarding the possibilities of Measure 48 and bonds, it might be a good idea, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that maybe we ask them back to sort of, and as you think about some of the questions we've posed here today, perhaps report back to us. I just really think that Measure 48 is a fly in the ointment of what this committee is charged with thinking about, emergency preparedness at all levels, and that we have to have some thought about how we can deal with it and manage if something ugly were to occur, and I think it's important for us to do this, and I think we should include that in our deliberations in September.
Yeah, I agree. And Kate, I mean, again, we hope this never happens, but if we don't plan for it now, and should we be handcuffed? I mean, we would be.
Go ahead. What would be useful to me, as I were trying to sort of trick out for you the different bonding programs, would be for you to describe the kinds of things you'd want to spend money on. Because often when we do bond analysis and tax analysis, I can tell you easy or hard based on, is it a road, a bridge, is it food, is it shelter? And we could think through some of our bond programs and how they would or would not be applicable.
For guidance, you just hit it. I mean, you just spoke the guidance. I mean, we're not... In what we're dealing with at our level and the committee, we're not talking about small business loans at this point. We're talking about disaster response. How do we pay to open the road, put in the culvert, blade it out? How do we get 30 helicopters for emergency services so that they can deliver food and supplies? How do we buy medical supplies? How do we fly people out of one place to move them to a hospital?
Mm-hmm.
How do we put people in temporary housing? I mean, we're talking catastrophic disaster response. We're not talking business development, economic development. I mean, we can figure that one out once we save all the lives that need to be saved.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to we are also, with Measure 48 now on the ballot, the treasurer is also taking these steps as well. This is exactly why we're asking these questions, because we need to also be doing contingency planning for if Measure 48 is in place, then what implications does that have for the bond programs right now, and what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And that's one reason the treasurer right now is evaluating this current calendar based on those questions, that we need to get more information so we can be, we have a little different world we're working in now, and if Measure 48 passes, it's definitely a different world, and so we need to know how to manage that program going forward.
Yeah, and you know, the revenue is outside of this, the purview of this committee, but I'm sure Representative Butler and Senator Ryan are both keenly interested in this. I'm going to hear more about this at the end of the month on my other committee. Representative Kraft.
Could you also provide for us a list of the current bond programs that have been approved by voters?
Well, specifically approved by voters or approved by voters?
Well, the language of this amendment, it says approved. It says specifically approved by voters.
That is the $24,000 question,
right?
Because the word specific is the key word.
It is.
And we're asking for guidance from the Attorney General. We can give you constitutionally authorized, but those are programs that have debt limits that are based on real market value, not mm-hmm. specifically approved. I'll give you two examples. One was OHSU. There was a specific ballot measure for a specific dollar amount, and the second one was the pension obligation bonds.
Okay.
And under the legislative fiscal office analysis, those are the only two bond issues that they have thus far opined as being within the definition of the measure as being outside of the cap.
Outside of the cap, okay.
Right, because that's the level of specificity that they've gone to.
Having already been approved by voters.
But those were sales that were specifically approved by voters, state bond sales.
And targeted at a particular area.
At a project. This... Whether the other constitutional bond programs fall in or out of the cap, their proceeds fall in or out of the cap, that's the question we're right now have posed before that. We can show you what it is, and maybe by your next meeting we'll have a better understanding on the with DOJ's advice. But right now we're not, frankly, sure if a bond program that's been approved, like the VETS program, is their mortgage program, whether that, although it's a constitutionally, it was voted on at the program once, whether that still, by the language of this measure, falls under these words.
Just to add on to that, we're also not sure for conduit revenue bond programs where the state doesn't even have proceeds that are appropriated, whether those are inside or outside of this cap. Examples would be housing, conduit revenue bonds for multifamily housing, mm-hmm. small business loans, and financing for nonprofits through Oregon Facilities Authority. We still have a lack of clarity on that as well.
Let's just say that our AG bill is starting to go on.
But we're working on it.
Great. More money we spend.
They charge us way too much anyway.
Oh, no. Mr. Chair, Representative Krepp, I beg to differ. They're a bargain.
They are, actually.
Great. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Just for the record, it's my understanding now from Legislative Council that, in fact, and this is coming from Dave Hendricks, that there's not actually a definition anywhere in statute for strictly emergency. There's for specific emergency communication districts and such, but not in and of itself emergency. What Legislative Council then would use in the case that it's not defined in statute is the Merriam-Webster International Unabridged Dictionary definition in those sorts of cases. And that definition in the dictionary right now states that an emergency is an unforeseen combination of circumstances or the resulting state that calls for immediate action, as a pressing need, b a sudden bodily alteration such as is likely to require immediate medical attention, or c an unusually distressing event or condition that can often be anticipated or prepared for but seldom exactly foreseen.
Judith, could you ask Dave to tell us what would transpire if we were to, as a committee, put into statute a definition of emergency? So if we defined emergency by statute through both chambers passed by the governor, how would that impact existing law, and how would that impact the future of Measure 48 should it pass.
Very good.
Because I think 48 is constitutional, right?
It is.
Correct.
But, okay. And, all right, yeah, that's good.
Very good.
Great, thanks. Robert King. Great, come on up, please. So, Mr. King, you can see the sort of things we get to deal with in this subcommittee.
Yes.
What we asked is to, you know, we've had through the various other subcommittees and the parent committee of emergency services, various, you know, entities, associations, so on and so forth, address concerns they have or outline ideas or concepts or shortfalls that they might perceive or see as a need in the event of a catastrophic event. You heard kind of the scenarios that, I mean, we are tasked with terrorism, catastrophic, you know, earthquake, tsunami, four or five things. But we're talking about not the day-to-day, and I realize from maybe Northeast Portland's a day-to-day event for you, but from a large catastrophic event, you know, the types of concerns you'd have, shortfalls we have, or things we might address at our level to make the cities, counties, associations have better resources.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. My name is Robert King. I'm the president of the Police Association in Portland, and I'm here also as a representative of the OCPA. I'm glad to spend some time with you talking about this topic. Actually, I was on vacation last week, received a call to come down on Thursday, and understood that the topic was disaster preparedness, disasters across a whole broad spectrum. And it occurred to me that you know, I think that in a variety of different ways, we in Portland are better prepared now than we have been historically. I know that with war protests, with since, of course, 9/11, the organization, the police bureau itself, I think, has done a better job at preparing. I also, though, think that it's really helpful that you're having a discussion and the committee's considering the topic in the way that it is, and that there'll be some guidance and or the research that's necessary to help the state be effective across both large and small agencies. I guess, you know, from the officer perspective, I think that you'll see in whatever event occurs, disaster or terrorist attack, that you'll have the same thing here in Oregon that you saw in New York City. The police officers and firefighters will be there. They'll be heroic and brave. And if the committee does really very little work, the one thing you can rely on and count on is that the cops and the firefighters on the street are going to be out there and they're going to protect people. That's what we do every day, and it's what they do even in extraordinary circumstances. But having said that, I, you know, since I found out I was going to come down here, I put calls into people on our bomb team and our SWAT team and made an effort to make contact with some folks that do emergency management work both in the police bureau and the city, and I haven't been able to have the kind of conversations with them that I'd like to. One of the concerns that I have is I'm sure the same sort of thing that happened in New Orleans or in Louisiana, and that is the officer's ability to be able to respond. And I think that we have some work to do as officers to be prepared to leave our homes and be gone for a period of time and be sure that our families are safe and that they have the food and the medical resources that they need. I think that's something that we can do on our own and that cops and firefighters across the state can do that can help us all be more prepared. I think there are some who have done that, although I don't think we have taken it seriously. You know, either there's a little bit of denial out there or there are a whole cross-section of priorities that take up our attention that, and we don't. This one isn't one of them, although I think it needs to be more on people's minds. So I think that's one thing that we can do. The other is I've noticed that when we have a plan in the police bureau, when it's a protest or any other event, when we have a plan to respond, it's when we're the most effective, it's when we're the most successful, and it's when we don't, I think that our effectiveness suffers. So I think internally in the metro area, having a conversation about planning and preparation is something that is something we need to do more of. I also, you know, this is one of the things I think that came out of the 9/11 Commission. I don't think that the state police has an 800 megahertz radio system. I know that there are agencies across the state that they don't have the ability to communicate with one another. I think we need to have, obviously, the responsibility of individual preparedness, but we have to be able to communicate with each other. And I don't know that we can do that. So if you can shed any light on that, or if there's any, you know, I know that in talking with one of our bond folks yesterday, we have some handheld radios that are not 800 megahertz, but allow us that if our radio system completely crashes, that we have the ability to put these in the hands of, say, 50 or 100 officers, and they can talk to each other across the city. And so having a method of communicating across these different boundaries and agencies, whether it's fire or police, whether it's cell phones or some of the radio system or improving the system we have, I think that over the next handful of years, I think that's something that's really important.
Just so you know, there's another committee, the technology committee,
Information
Technology Committee, that's tasked with working on the state interoperability communications plan. And there is a, for better word, a working group that's trying to merge the four state systems into one state system, which obviously there's economies of effect right there, and then making it cost-effective enough to be able to integrate, or the goal is to integrate all of the local departments. And a lot of the discussion is based around the system you already have in Portland, simply because if the 800-pound gorilla already has X, then you don't want to buy 800 pounds of something new.
Right, sure.
That is a federal mandate for 2013, and so this is not a luxury. It's not an option for the state of Oregon. You eventually got to get there. The question is, it's like everything else, how do you figure out how to pay for it?
Right, right. So. Well, one of the things I would like the opportunity to do, I understand that you're meeting again in September. I'd like to engage more folks in this conversation in Portland. We're actually doing a membership survey of our 950 members. I'd like to ask them if they're prepared or not, and what they need to be more prepared. I'd like to. I know that that the Rosie Sizer, our chief, Scott Weiniger is the captain who's in charge of emergency planning. I know there's an emergency management system in Portland. I frankly don't know very much about it. And I like the opportunity of doing a little bit more research, getting some answers to questions, and being able to come back to you and share. You know, I have those initial concerns of just being prepared ourselves, being able to be being confident that we have a plan, that there's training and there's equipment that's there for us to help us do our jobs, that we're able to communicate with one another. But I'd like to be able to come back to you with a little more substance and a little, having given it a little bit more thought, and weigh in a way that maybe is a little more helpful.
That'd be good. And September 26th is the date, and if you'd be in touch with Judith,
I'll be glad
we'll make sure you get there, because we're going to approach the, hopefully approach the legislative concepts in about three folds. One fold is a priority group of bills that we need to go forward with. The second group is a group of potential concerns that individual members of the committee may carry forward into the next legislative. And then the third one is a more of a committee entity of figuring out, okay, we need to get serious about funding and priority of funding and how we're funding it. Because, of course, that goes through the Joint Ways and Means process, which is, I don't even understand, but it goes somewhere to the basement and comes back out. But we do invite you back on the 26th of September.
Mr. Chair.
It's actually a full committee here.
Sure.
It's full committee here.
Very good. I'll be here.
And there'll be 14 wieldy people here.
So. All right, very well.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
What I'd like to do is get Scott, you're here, and I think you're going to bring Paul up too. You guys can come up. And we had someone representing the cities at the Umatilla subcommittee hearing. But what I want to do is give you another opportunity. I mean, emergency preparedness. I never send money. We're familiar with that. But give you an opportunity to kind of address some city concerns that you might have.
Mr. Chairman, I would echo some Scott Winkles with the League of Oregon Cities. I would echo some of the concerns of your last speaker, and that one of the major things the state can do for our members is to get OWIN, Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, online. That, mm-hmm. That's the key. Financial resources are going to be important. For instance, on the coast, the tsunami, we pay for our public safety out of general fund revenues.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we're looking at those funds will become depleted. Our tax base could be severely damaged by storms.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be our typical concerns.
Paul, anything you want to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Staff, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I would agree with Scott's observations. something that we've been working with the state health officer, Dr. Allen, with regard to the counties differ somewhat from the cities in the sense that we cover the entire scope of the county, and we do primarily the health and mental health issues that cities don't get as much into as we do. And so issues that involve things like anthrax or a pandemic flu epidemic, in addition to the tsunami kinds of scenarios that we've discussed this morning, are of primary concern to us as well. And we've been working with the Human Services Department to try to take a close look at the statutes to be sure, first of all, that there aren't any gaps, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where there's a crisis and nobody has the authority to take the kind of action that's warranted by the circumstances. So we want to be sure that that's covered. In working with other interest groups, though, on this, on the health issues, we've identified the Hospitals Association, the Medical Association, the Nurses Association. Other organizations have expressed concerns about that they would like to have some insulation from liability for the kinds of actions that government directs them to take or the circumstances require them to do. And one of the problems that we're confronting now under that situation is a case, a lawsuit that's come out of the Court of Appeals about 6 weeks ago. And that case is Clark versus Oregon Health Sciences University. The difficulty that that case presents is this. There's a section of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, which says that it says every man, it's called a remedy clause, it says every man shall have remedy by due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation. And that's been construed by both the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals to say that you can't eliminate a remedy that existed in 1857 when the state became a state unless you provide an adequate substitute remedy in its place. And the Supreme Court has dealt with that in a procedural way. What the Court of Appeals did 6 weeks ago was to say, well, this is also a substantive issue. And this case has been described by several folks as an example of the notion that hard cases make bad law. And the circumstances are very egregious. The damages that were pleaded by the plaintiff exceeded $12 million. And the tort claim limits that apply to a government body, or in that case, were $200,000. And the Court of Appeals said, well, this doesn't cut it. This is not an adequate remedy based on the pleadings. And so, therefore, we need to do two things. One is look at these things on a case-by-case basis rather than as a class. And secondly, that we find that a physician or a nurse or somebody who provides these medical services in the year 1857 would have been liable under the remedy clause. And although government has a limit against its liability, that limit in this situation does not apply to the individual that performed the service. So, therefore, what we find are a couple of things under this case. One is that basically we don't have any tort claims limits as a practical matter any longer, because although government is limited, the people who work for government may not be limited. And therefore, we have a provision in the law that says that we'll reimburse those individuals who act on our behalf, and so therefore we don't have the liability limits. The other aspect of this that's also disturbing is that you take that same issue and apply it to a host of Good Samaritan laws that the legislature has put on the books. And so if you have an emergency medical technician who acts without compensation in order to deal with an emergency situation, that individual is not liable except for gross negligence. Same thing with use of a defibrillator. The same thing with respect to emergency transportation, that basically the legislature has over the years said, if you do something in an emergency situation that we find a public benefit that outweighs what might be a harm to the individual, because we want to encourage people to take this action. And we would think that the individual would want that to happen too. So the problems that we have now are our exposure at the government level for actions that we don't have the discretion to avoid. That basically we must provide police services, we must provide fire services, we must provide health services, and we don't get to pick and choose who we provide it to. Mm-hmm. In the scenario that's been described this morning by members of the committee about the tsunami, I think the potential liability with respect to government could break the bank very easily in terms of the exposure that this represents. And the other aspect of it that's equally damaging is that it causes hesitation on the part of public officials to take action that they would otherwise find to be the appropriate action to take. The reason why I'm telling you all this is because this case is now before the Supreme Court on a writ of review. The Supreme Court has not decided whether or not to take the case yet. If it declines the case, then the Court of Appeals opinion stands as the law of the land. If it accepts the case, then it can do something different. But if it doesn't change, if the Court of Appeals case stands, either because the Supreme Court rejects review or the Supreme Court upholds the Court of Appeals, then I expect that we're going to be coming back to you to get some modification of this law, and since it's a constitutional provision, it may be a constitutional change that we ask for.
And Paul, that's because on the top of page 2 of our recommendations, and Representative McPherson raised this several times in the past, both sides of the sword he raised. One was the side of public liability. I mean, is there, and we had Dave Hendricks in there, and there was a quasi, yes, we have a good law, except they mentioned the case you have, and that is would the cities, counties, districts be held harmless in responding to a catastrophic event? And up until this case you just mentioned, the answer was yes, but now that's out the window. And then the second issue that Representative McPherson had raised was ensuring, you know, in the same liability issue, that caregivers, for example, hospitals and stuff like that, understood that they were responsible for the evacuation of their patients and so on and so forth like that. I would ask that you know, based on how the law or how the Supreme Court rules or decides, that you come back to us, because we are going to sponsor legislation to address those two issues. Because, cities and counties are going to bear the brunt of these disasters, period, end of subject. The state's going to be in a supporting role for the most part, trying to get down there and provide the assistance that the local folks need, if there are local folks there. And then to, no disrespect, I'll have the lawyers thrown in the middle of this isn't going to work. And so we need to address that issue.
Sure.
One thing I did want the two of you both to address, and that is, in the committee has not gone forward in any particular direction on this, and that is based on the fact cities are close combined units, how do you see the pandemic flu response? I mean, we really in the state have two competing ideas. Idea one is stockpile, be prepared to respond to the event up front. And the other response is have a plan and wait and see what happens. So therefore, many states are going out and stockpiling drugs and medical supplies, and some are not. Since you represent, obviously, the local governments below us and the cities, are obviously a focal point because it will spread that fast in the cities. Have you guys done much on pandemic flu planning, and what is your druthers? Wait and see, or the other?
Mr. Chairman, the planning is ongoing for most of Oregon cities. There's a conference next week with DHS, ODHS is putting on. Different cities have taken different measures. I think the best thing is to prepare, and then we can wait and see. I mean, my understanding is that the evidence on the effectiveness of stockpiling, the Tamiflu or the other antivirals, that may not be such a good idea, depending on what the virus decides to do with when and if it mutates. But I can think of five or six cities off the top of my head that have had major planning summits to date, and more coming.
Well, it's true we're planning things to death, but I'm not sure we're preparing at times. So,
Mr. Chair, you may want to have a conversation with Dr. Allen about this issue. She's one of the few people in the world who has ever really dealt with some of the things that we're describing, because she was the health officer for the county in which the Pentagon was located, well, is located, when 9/11 occurred. And she has also dealt with anthrax. So there aren't very many people who have actually dealt with this in an emergency situation, but she has. And one of the things that I think is important, if I understand correctly, the issue with regard to avian flu is that it would require a mutation of the virus for it to be able to be transmitted human to human. And the very fact that it would require a change in the virus would kind of indicate that perhaps stockpiling some antidote based on a previous form of it would probably not be the best thing to do.
Yeah, Dr. Allen has been before this meeting no less than four times.
Okay.
And I think she's been in my office three or four times, too. So very, very familiar with that. And as you well know, I mean, CDC, there's a split. I mean, CDC is recommending one thing, and the federal government's going one direction. Sometimes the federal government goes in the right direction, and sometimes it doesn't. So we have to see there. One of the at the local level, and Judith raised the issue here too, and I guess food for thought. And Seaside's a good example, which is very well prepared. You know, has actually addressed emergency water supply, some food. Unfortunately, the issue of body bags, medical supplies, and things like that. Do you have a feeling of other outside of the tsunami areas? What other cities have addressed those types of issues?
Cities that have been prone to live in the fire zones, endangered wildfire, have had some plans in place for a number of years, evacuation plans, those sorts of things. I don't know off the top of my head how many other cities have stockpiled supplies and what plans, but I'd be happy to provide that for you.
Yeah, I don't need that. I mean, we're just, I think from a basis, I mean, we're only trying to prod people along to plan. As you well know, the Red Cross is, you know, standard boilerplate is 72 hours, and 72 hours isn't going to work in a tsunami and an earthquake. The committee has come to the distinct conclusion that, based on good professional input, that power, food, water isn't going to be there in 72 hours. So it's not going to be a good enough planning cycle to make things work. So great, appreciate it, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr.
And Judith, we have this room this afternoon too. Is anyone on the public testimony over there?
I think just Paul.
And Paul
Schneider was on there.
And he's already on?
Yes. We've already heard from him. I don't know if we need to start the discussion with Ken Murphy on our local civilian this afternoon. We'll wait for more members.
No, I'm not going to wait. What I would like to do, and correct me if I'm wrong, is I would like to recess till 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Just in case there's public intent. And then if it is legally permissible, then I'd like to have a open work group in here at starting at 11:20.
Okay.
And if Ken and Mike and whoever else is available in the cities and counties are more than welcome, then at 11:20 we just have an open work group to run down the list of considerations.
Okay.
Trying to wean it down into something everybody agrees is a priority, not a priority, and then we can address those at the public hearing at 1 o'clock with more committee members. So with that, I'm going to recess until 1 o'clock, and I would ask those that are interested, and I would ask specifically Ken and Mike, for our community response of the Emergency Preparedness Committee back to order, and we are in the public comment period, after which we're going to ask the State Fire Marshal to come up. But we'll do public comment first, and Lorna Walker, if you want to come up to the podium. And I would ask that when you get up there that you state your name so that it's on the public record. And then we're delighted to...
Good afternoon. My name is Lorna Walker. And the reason that I'm here today is that over the last year, as I have observed the activities, discussions, hearings, etc., regarding emergency preparedness, gradually over a period of time, I have been prompted to make a few notes on some things. And they're under constant revision. And the form in which I present them to you is what I would consider to be in a draft form, because depending on to what group one presents it, the format would be designated to change. What I'll do first is talk to you some about kits that one might develop on the home front, in the household, and in the school, speaking only in terms of the students themselves, not necessarily of the school organization. And discuss a little bit the lists that I'm presenting to you, organization matters that would be important, mobility, storage, recycling, and dissemination, whether it's to a school, whether it is to a home care service, and I know that they're developing their own reserve of ideas, or whether it is to some community service organization that might facilitate this process. Absolutely wonderful thought and preparation has gone into the overall planning that the committees and the agencies have been doing. My first thought was that one should take this perhaps to Homeland Security. But because, as I said, it's under constant revision, here I am. First of all, on the cover of this little, loosely I'll use the term, document that I'm presenting to you, I've stated that these emergency resource kits and their potential content are the suggestions are presented as we have gone through the reassessment and readjustment of the management of emergency and unexpected events, and encouraging citizens to take more responsibility for themselves, to provide immediate help and care for themselves and those about them. Now, each household is going to have different priorities. And so that as one starts assembling kits, your organization and your content may be different. Your style of living is going to vary. Kits, as they are presented, are kits that would, things that should always be kept in your car, kits that you would have in your car in some circumstances, kits that would be mobile that you would just grab and pull after you on wheels or something like that. And I will mention that one of the items listed in here is respirators. Respirators come in different forms, and they have filters that are designed for particles, chemicals, etc. And those are not always so easy to find. Places that sell them are often found in industrial areas or sometimes in the companies that market equipment for road working crews or industrial working crews. And those items must be stored in such a way that your filters are kept clean. And many of the other things that are in here are things that in many households, they may have almost everything that is in the kit or in the groups of kits. But the way that they are organized does not make them easily accessible or mobile. In other households, there may be very few things contained in these kits that exist in those households. Therefore, there must be developed a strategy over a period of time to help these households both accumulate and organize and maintain these kits and their contents. The second letter, notice there's no heading on it, is something that, for example, in a school situation or in a service group organization, this letter could be disseminated that people might send out to relatives or acquaintances, etc., that would alert them to what they might be doing. And some of these items are items which could be used as gift items to help families accumulate the contents of the kits. When we talk about emergency supply kits, we need to think about first aid kits, and how your first aid kit is organized may generate a change of thinking in what you put in the contents. For example, when we get to first aid kits, if you organize it so that your ointments come first in your inventory list, you think about it differently than if you have your scissors and tweezers, etc., coming first. Little things that change our way of thinking are important. Toiletry kits, an auto kit. An auto kit is different from those items which one should always have in their auto, such as actually inside the auto where the driver is, there should be some type of a crowbar or that type of thing that one could use to extricate themselves if they needed to in any circumstance. Food kits. This is very difficult for most of us to contemplate what should go in a food kit that can be maintained over a period of time. Much of it would have to be inside a foil because plastics and paper are somewhat vulnerable to, I'm going to say, microlife. And what goes into that, how it's organized and how it's recycled is important and would also implicate that in the event of a disaster, which we, of course, would like to think we won't have to face, but nevertheless, we should be prepared for that that we might take care of ourselves if it were necessary. Provision of food would be a very high priority on a larger scale level. A sleep kit, such as if you were out where you were going into the woods or something like that, your tent and backpack and that type of thing. A little bit of money that you have, whether it's for a telephone call, whether it's whatever it's for, in terms of both coins and bills, one should have with them. And then the obvious things like flares and whistles. You know, when I was thinking, we've always been advised in school circumstances to have a whistle available. The thought that occurred to me is one thing that I don't think I ever heard recommended was a penny whistle, because one could make sound on a penny whistle a lot longer than they could on a little blowing whistle, and it would carry much farther. And they fit quite compactly. Then, additionally, one needs to have in some one of these, a change of clothing. And one is talking about, and of course we left out the emergency backpack kit for children at school, which they have to have a place to store, and there's a minimal storage space, but if it's handled efficiently, it can be done. And when students are trained to go on their fire drill, they automatically pick their backpack up, put it on their shoulder, and walk out the door with it, and it can be done in just as timely a way as having that fire drill without that backpack if it's well organized. And then things that are maybe less obvious is that for each kit, there need to be duplicate inventory lists that are updatable, and copies of those lists need to be maintained in the first aid kit so that when you open your first aid kit and you need something, you know exactly where to look for it, and as that is recycled, you have record of the recycling, and that it is updatable as contents are used from it. Then, if you look at the first aid kits, there are some things in there that are not traditionally contained in first aid kits, but in the case of an emergency, could be extremely helpful to have available. Another item, which I haven't really discussed, that should go in your first aid kit would be a set of conversion lists, which could be presented in a very compact folder that is laminated, that gives you conversion measurement conversion lists for food items, for assorted substances, for altitude, metric conversion charts, etc. So that if one were in an emergency circumstance and certain contents were available, but somebody in the flurry of it all couldn't recall what the conversion was, it's right there before them ready to use. In your auto or your truck kit, there are some things in there that would be variable depending upon your location, whether you're close to the mountains, whether you're close to the ocean, whether you're in an urban area, that type of thing. And your food kit, again, dry canned foiled food, you have to be very careful with your dry, your paper products, and in terms of the vulnerability of the packaging, and an extra set of clothing always available. Boots, a high priority, so that if it's necessary that one do extensive walking, you have a good broken-in, ready-to-use pair of boots available. And from there on, the other items that are of real importance are having available laminated directories for local, county, state, federal emergency numbers and addresses. Conveniently, a telephone directory for the area that you're in, address and phone directories for personal contacts, maps, thank you cards, hiking boots, a power inverter for your vehicle so that if you have a laptop or if you have some means of heating something that wouldn't be used otherwise, that you have a means of conversion for it. Now, when we discuss these lists, everybody's going to organize the contents differently. They're going to choose to focus on different kits initially. Things that present themselves as challenges are mobility, because some plastic containers, although they might be waterproof, if something's stacked on them, they're going to break. Some of us are very uncomfortable carrying things on our shoulders, so we want something on wheels. If it's raining extensively, then we need something that is fairly waterproof for certain things. And then in terms of storage, what about storage in the home area? If you have these items and you have them properly packaged and you have stored them in the most remote portion of your garage or your attic or your storage area, whatever it might be, you haven't really done yourself a great kindness. Having things accessible in time of need is quite significant. Then in terms of dissemination, this can be done in several ways. Just people taking their individual personal responsibility. And sometimes, some of us are not great organizers, and sometimes this can seem like quite a major obstacle. For people who have a fetish for organization, is it the type A? Then that's not such a big deal, but some other aspect of it may be a big deal. Can be done through the schools, through COSA, through the education associations. It can be done through, service organizations can facilitate both communication and encouragement and support for generation of these types of packs greatly. Additionally, there are some lovely sections in the newspaper. I noticed on Friday's paper there is I've forgotten the exact title, something about living, a little insert in the paper, and they present all kinds of handy tips for various aspects of life. Focus changes week by week. The type of thing that we're talking about here is not something that is necessarily going to happen in a day in all families. Therefore, there need to be, over a period of time, a repetitive set of reminders that may happen in different forms. And this can be done through newspapers, through brochures, through various forms of advertisement. But in this little insert in the newspaper, I was noticing not too long ago they had something about a certain type of kits and things that one would want to have in it. Reminders of these things and tips for organizations on these things for a period of about 6 years should come on a monthly to quarterly basis. At schools, the generation, by this time, for most school administrators, it's a little late to get contents of this type of thing into the school handbook, because most schools either have it in a final draft form or they already have it printed. But can be done in a brochure fashion to be attached. In schools, September is a significant time for training students for the various patterns of activities that will be required of them during the year. And that training is revisited again in January, because elementary school students, when they leave for Christmas, when they come back in January, it almost feels like September all over again, with a lot of things to be revisited. So a couple of times a year, this needs to be revisited through the schools, considering the high level of mobility in some schools where there is a turnover of population within the school. And so at this point, I would say, do you have any questions? You've probably heard more than you would care to from me.
Well, Ms. Walker, we appreciate your testimony. Senator, do you have anything?
Ms. Walker, I do. I've thought a lot about storage.
Yes.
And if I prepare my kit and I do it very well and I have everything that I think I'm going to need and I have an earthquake, I sit up on a quite nice hill. Hopefully I'm on rock. But regardless of that, if my house falls and I have to get outside, where do you think is the best place to put my kit?
I think you would have to consider your pattern of movement and the design of your location. when a family makes their emergency exit plans for their home, that should be as close as possible to your emergency exit, ready to just move with you. And I have thought about this a lot also, because I was thinking, well, should there be an emergency, and I was in my vehicle, there might be some things that I would expect that I might need that I might not have with me. Or if I was at home and a family member was gone with the vehicle, there might be some things that I would need that I'm not sure I would be comfortable in carrying. Therefore, the suggestion for mobility, a good pair of boots that are well broken in. And the other thing that I was thinking about, what about in terms of the schools? Space is at such a premium in the schools. When we look at the organization of classrooms, we talk about class size in a classroom. I don't think I've heard anyone talk about the relationship between the number of square feet in the room, the usage for that room, and the number of students, the relationship of those things. Because regardless of what you have for class size in that room, if the room is this size, you have one set of problems. If it's this size, you have a different set of problems. The more students that you have in the room, the more space you need. Because in order to have the enrichment types of activities that should be a part of any good class design, it requires space beyond the shape of a desk to be able to generate that. Well, when you add another component, such as emergency packs, that is another facet. So the question then in a school is, do we want each child to carry their own pack, or do we want each child to present a pack which is stored in a specific area and one truck is responsible for moving all of those packs immediately? I mean, there are dozen different ways. So whether I'm at home or whether I'm at school, there are organizational and storage factors to be considered. I was thinking as I was coming here, what about if I decide that I'm going to store a kit, let's say hypothetically that I have a nice pickup truck and I've got a bench, what do you call those things? trunk is all I can think of in the back of the truck. And I have lots of storage space in that. It's not necessarily insulated. What about the problems of storing some things in terms of freezing weather and 90 or 100 degree weather? Are some things going to be useless after they're stored in that circumstance? If so, when I organize my packs, I need to know that, and I need to know that I have those items stored in such a way that they are fresh and usable and not already perished when I need to use them. There are many factors to think about. And as I said, I've been making notes on this for several months now, and every time I revisit it, I think of something that really should have been added in there or that might better be organized a different way. If you have little children and they have a backpack, they need a fresh set of undies and socks in that backpack. They're much more comfortable knowing they've got that. Just like they need their toothbrush and some toothpaste. If you are an individual who is by yourself, you might have different organizational factors to consider than a family with two children or six children. If your family is larger, then you will need more of certain supplies. Maybe each family needs to, each member of the family needs to have their own kit in certain areas. There are just many different things to think about.
Okay.
And so, and the other thing is, of course, the logical things like, you know, tools. And I was speaking with a gentleman this morning. One of the things that has been very prominent in my thinking since I started looking over this is, let's say hypothetically, that there were a disaster event which was a little more dramatic than we'd like to think about. And people who were well organized got themselves properly located and were using the resources of their kits, etc. What are they going to need in a fairly reasonable period of time that they could not logically include in those kits or carry with them? They're going to need some kind of a generator. Power generator. They're going to need probably batteries, whether it's an auto battery as a backup auto battery or for communication. Communication is another issue. There's been so much discussed in the various hearings regarding the revamping and restructuring of the communication infrastructure. I feel personally a little unsettled because at this point I don't know whether I would need a shortwave radio, whether I need a certain type of telephone, or whether I need something entirely different. Now, I oftentimes think of things that haven't been invented yet and assume that it's already done. And so sometimes when I suggest things, I'm thinking it's already completed and maybe it hasn't gotten started yet. But I would picture that I would be able to connect my little laptop computer in and somehow have appropriate communication with whatever agency or whatever person or individuals that I might need to communicate with. But I don't really know if there's a way that I can do that under the existing infrastructure. And I know I've heard others asking, you know, where we are in this terms, and I've heard many excellent presentations of what is being done in various areas, but I'm not sure how I and what I have fits into that scenario, or if it does. And that interests me, and I think that it would interest a lot of other people also.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Ponce? Well, thank you, Ms. Barker. We appreciate your presentation. And we'll take the list into consideration as we move towards having the voters' pamphlet.
Well, I trust that it will all work out appropriately. I thank you for taking the time to hear my little comments and suggestions. The work that has been done by the committees, I think, is quite impressive.
Thank you, ma'am.
And I know that everyone will benefit from the results of it. Thank you for your time.
I'll ask the state fire marshal.
While they're coming up, Mr. Chairman, one thing, you know, that Mrs. Walker mentioned money. And after Katrina, there were many members of my family that like to just use debit cards and don't carry cash. And they think the bank is going to be open for, you know, forever. And they found that they were really worried about groceries because they wanted only cash customers. And they didn't have electricity. It was dark. And they had been working long hours, and they were grumpy, and the employees weren't happy to have people coming in pleading their case because they didn't have cash money. So I think that that's something to be thought of, that people need some amount of cash money in case of a disaster, that they're able to buy baby formula, water, whatever it is. And when the systems are down in the grocery stores, which we experienced quite recently, all the systems went down on the coast as a result of something. I'm at a loss right now as to... That was it.
Internet and satellite.
Everything went down, and people couldn't do business, and so that was the thing. Welcome.
So, if you please identify yourself, and we'll go forward from there.
All right. Chair Boquist, Senator Berger, Nancy Orr, State Fire Marshal. With me is Stacey Warner, who manages and directs our fire prevention programs.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I understand that you asked for some information about our communication resources, and we recently put into service an advanced communications vehicle. Mm-hmm. It's affectionately known by the technicians who use it as the big red radio truck named BERT.
Okay.
This communication vehicle has every communication capacity that we currently have. All radio frequencies, satellite phone, cell phone, voiceover, you name it, we have it on there, as well as what's called a black box or an ACU 1000 that links disparate communication technology together. So, for example, we can have people working on cell phones, radios, landlines, and they can all be linked together through this box. The vehicle is self-sufficient, and as well as the equipment that's on the vehicle can also be portable for remote locations. It's staffed, as I said, by some communications specialists. These folks are from the Oregon Amateur Radio Emergency Services Areas. You may have heard of those. There's a number of chapters around the state, and they're incredibly talented, have been hand-picked for this assignment, and are experienced with emergency operations. We've been very thrifty in how we have developed this. The vehicle itself is a surplus regional hazmat response team vehicle. It's actually Portland Fire Bureau's. It was rotated out and replaced. And the funding for the equipment and retrofit on this came from Federal Homeland Security grants, specifically for communication equipment for the Urban Search and Rescue Task Force in Oregon, as well as some state fire marshal funds. We first exercised this vehicle in June, early June, when we had a drill of the Urban Search and Rescue Task Force, a simulated structural collapse up at the Portland Fire Bureau Training Center. We deployed it at the Foster Gulch Fire over by Halfway. That was its first official deployment. That was the first conflagration fire where we had effective communication between the incident management team, command post, and firefighters in the field. When that fire was demobilized, we moved the vehicle over to the Black Crater Fire in near Sisters. We will deploy this vehicle anytime we have a drill or an actual incident, all-risk incident, anytime that we mobilize an incident management team. The State Fire Marshal has three Type 2 incident management teams that we deploy anytime state resources are deployed. This vehicle has also been requested with the communications capability and an incident management team for the 2008 Olympic trials in Eugene. So we look forward to using it then. Any questions?
Could you put a price tag on the whole package? If you had to replicate it, what would it cost to replicate?
Oh, gosh, $500,000.
And that includes the handhelds, I'm assuming. What type of handhelds are on here?
Portable handheld radios.
Are we talking Motorola, or are we talking what kind of technology?
ICOMs.
ICOMs? Okay. And what's the range once you have the system in place? I'm assuming it has an antenna system that goes up. What kind of range does that give you on your handheld?
We've an actual demonstration of this was when we had the funeral in Madras for the young National Guard soldier. We had communications from Bend to Madras, including outside and inside the fairgrounds in Redmond. So the range is improved by the fact that we have the portable repeaters that we can set up.
This is your question, Senator?
That's all right. Go ahead.
This, I mean, how bulky? I mean, you said the vehicle. Could this be put on, could a package of this be developed and put on board a helicopter and moved to someplace?
Components of it could, yes.
So the vehicle is a 2.5-ton, 5-ton van?
You know, you're asking me a lot of technical questions, Representative, which I do not know the answer to. And our radio specialist at the office is out this week replacing the aged FireNet equipment, mountaintop microwave system for FireNet. So I'm sorry. I really can't answer all the technical questions that you have.
And the integration of it, though, it's you're able to integrate this with, you know, the Portland Police Department, Eugene Police Department. It has the capability, because it's the 800 megahertz system, it has to integrate with state police.
It has the capability to integrate with all communication systems currently used in the state of Oregon.
All four of them.
Radio, phone.
Okay. And the reason I'm wondering is I mean, this is the sort of package that we talked about having the ability to put in Coos Bay or Seaside should something happen. Now, obviously, I doubt we could sling load your vehicle on one of our CH-47s the way it's configured, but I'm just wondering, you know, if you took the vehicle away and had a ground unit package that you could load on a CH-47 helicopter and move to someplace, what the cost of that would be to replicate. And you said it's Homeland Security grant, and how much of your funds did you put into state funds?
$10,000-$20,000 at the most, probably.
And the rest is Homeland Security?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what the cost would be to replicate this again and put it someplace.
Well, having the surplus vehicle really helped a lot. That's where a lot of the major cost comes from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good questions there?
The problem I think that we see with major disasters, a 9-point earthquake or a major tsunami, is that the roads would be blocked. And so those are some of the discussions that we've had. But this vehicle would be used regardless of whether there was a fire or a law enforcement issue. I mean, if there was a human need, then your vehicle would be available. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's designed for all risks, any type of emergency, or, as I said, even non-emergency, such as the Olympic trials.
The one thing I would ask you to come back to, and if I can come back to Judith with this, I would be very interested in the exact replication cost.
All right.
If you have a second vehicle that's like this, and then the third, the second thing is on that, would you be interested in what a ground use package would look like? What would it cost to develop a ground use package that, frankly, you could load on a CH-47? And I believe General Caldwell will be more than happy to give you the dynamics of that, if not a probably more likely a Blackhawk helicopter. And if you were tasked to move and set a communications network up has not existed outside of what the military has on its aircraft, what that would cost. Because as you well know, we're 4 to 6 years away from an interoperability system in the state of Oregon, which doesn't leave some of us very warm and fuzzy what we're going to do if something breaks down between now and then. So any other questions, Senator?
No, I think that's fine.
Great. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate you taking the time to come here. And seeing no one else has signed up, I'm going to close this subcommittee informational meeting. Judith, what's the verdict?
Okay. At the moment, we do have a confirmation that we have a quorum from the House. We will wait for confirmation. I have now left messages or Representative Krieger's case of facts, asking them to confirm whether or not they're able to attend tomorrow. I will keep checking on that over this next hour to see if I get a response from the other senators whether or not they're able to attend. But they all have phone messages asking for their whether or not they'll attend so we can know whether or not we have a quorum. We do have a quorum on the House side already.
Okay.
Confirmed.
those check marks.
And how short again are you on the Senate side?
Right now, just Senator Berger is confirmed. But we just need three more. So we need four each, yeah. And just some more information. This came in from Surf Simple Technologies, which is breaking down very specifically on costs, although I will point out some of the information. Oh, I guess the population estimates are from 2004. This is the information they set had also just emailed me today on those costs.
And who is this?
This is Parshant Marshall, the president of the Surf Simple Technologies.
Is the one in Umatilla?
This, no, he's the one that came to Cannon Beach.
Okay.
Remember the fellow that gave the presentation at Cannon Beach?
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't there.
That this is the.
And this is for reverse 911, or is this?
This is reverse 911. Okay. Sorry, I should have actually.
Okay, this isn't the one that was talking about wiring the state.
No, this is.
For 3.5 million, you know, we can wire the state for that. We spend it now. We go to the e-board and get the money.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, last but not least, is the Water Resources Congress asking for the expansion of ODOT authority. That's her, Anita Winkler's memo about that. So you can review that information. And then I will go ahead now and redo our list for tomorrow. And shall we meet in Senator Verger's office at 3 o'clock?
3 o'clock. Is that confusing,
Senator? Okay, that's great.
Just over an hour from now.
Okay.
We'll be there at 3 o'clock.
Okay, very good.